Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic. 101 northbound in the East Valley. A disabled vehicle at Via de Ventura blocks the left lane. Look for sunny skies, breezy conditions for the rest of the day today. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-60s. Sunny and 84 for a high tomorrow. Also breezy conditions, 81 for a high on Thursday. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now. It's 90 degrees. And it is, of course, Election Day. And while many Arizonans have already cast their ballots, a lot of voters are showing up to the polls today. And there have been some reports of long lines and malfunctioning equipment at various polling locations. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block and Casey Kuhn have been out and about today across the valley, and they join me. So, Casey, let's start with you. First off, where were you and what did you see?
Well, I went to seven different polling locations, and in the Maryvale polling place, people were waiting really long in the early part of the day because of some problems that they had with the e-poll books. At the other places in Levine and Avondale and South Phoenix, there weren't that many lines, and people said that it was running pretty smoothly. But back in the Maryvale location later in the afternoon, one voter, Jonathan Gutierrez, finally got to cast his ballot.
It was a lot more smoother last election than it was this time, but you have problems too where people are coming from different places and then they think they can vote anywhere. And that's how I thought it was too.
Gutierrez was in line in Maryvale with his young son early in the morning after going to the wrong location, waiting 2 hours, leaving in frustration, and coming back again.
Now, we've heard some reports about long lines. Casey mentioned technology issues inside the polling places. Jude, did you encounter any of that?
I was at the Salvation Army in downtown Phoenix in the late morning, and there had been long lines right from the get-go, right at 6 a.m. Some people said as long as an hour. Some people said as long as 2 hours. By the time I got there at 10, the line was really moving. I drove past again at 11:30. There was no line. So it seems like the problem might have been resolved, though, of course, fewer people were voting. And I was told it was also an e-poll book issue. That's the technology they use to check in voters.
Now, some advocacy groups are upset about some of the delays this morning. Jude, what are they saying?
Outside of the Salvation Army this morning, the Basta Arpaio campaign had a press conference. That's the campaign that's trying to oust Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio from being reelected. They said they'd noticed problems at 18 out of 50 polling places that they had been monitoring. They claimed that there were lines longer than 30 minutes, which had been Maricopa County recorder Helen Purcell's goal, that only 5% or fewer of voters should wait longer than 30 minutes. Let's take a listen to Randy Parras.
People having to wait 45 minutes to an hour and then leaving to go back to work. We call that voter suppression. Voter suppression does not require intent. It requires outcome. And that's happening. The precincts we're looking at are not all the precincts. They're predominantly Latino precincts.
So he's with the Basta Arpaio campaign. They're asking the county recorder to keep locations open longer where there were problems. There's been no response to that. So the Basta Arpaio campaign says they're going to be asking the DOJ. But everyone should still assume that polls will close at 7 p.m. tonight. Anyone in line before 7 is allowed to vote.
Now, Casey, when you were out at different polling locations, it sounds like there was a fair amount of confusion over where voters actually needed to go in order to cast their ballots.
Right. A lot of the people I talked to did think they could cast their ballot in any location. And at one of the Levine polling places, I met Dan Mullaney, who went to the place he usually votes on Dobbins and 51st Avenue, waited an hour there. And then when he got to the front, was told he had to go to another place in Levine, and he wasn't the only one.
Got in and then was told I was in the wrong location. While I was there, actually, there was a couple other people that were sent in there from a Cesar Chavez school location. And they told to go down to the Dobbins location. And then Dobbins said, no, you got to go back to Cesar Chavez location.
And this has been an ongoing issue in Arizona elections. The law says that if you are in the wrong polling location, your ballot won't count. Even if you get a provisional ballot, that ballot won't count. So poll workers have been instructed to tell voters to go to the right polling place. Of course, it's unfortunate if they have to wait in line twice, but that's the way that their ballot will count.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, along with Casey Kuhn, talking about issues at polling places on this election day. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Jude and Casey referenced some of the issues at polling places today, and we heard some of the frustrations expressed by voters. For more on that, I'm joined by KJZZ's Kerry Young, who's back from the Maricopa County Election Office. And Kerry, what did county election officials have to say about what might be behind some of those issues we've heard about?
Yeah, I checked in with Elizabeth Bartholomew, who is a spokesperson for the recorder's office. She was at the Ballot Tabulation Center in downtown Phoenix this morning. We checked in with her after the hearing about some of those e-poll book issues that we were talking about, and she said there wasn't really one thing to blame with those.
It was just kind of random things. It was like, it would be like one in a polling place of four e-poll books or something. And so, you know, it's electronics, it's technology. Your phone freezes, your laptop freezes, your iPad freezes, stuff like that.
She said some e-poll books didn't have charged batteries, others just froze. It was a variety of things, but she said they did manage to send out some backups that the county had on hand and just switch them out. Bartholomew also said that the e-poll book issues were primarily the cause behind some of those hour, hour and a half long waits that we heard about. But once those were resolved, the lines reduced significantly. She even went as far as saying, as you know, when we talked at about noon today, some of those polling locations were a little bit slow.
So, Kerry, you were at the Ballot Tabulation Center earlier today. What was the scene like there?
Well, the scene was pretty busy there. Most of what was going on had to do with the employees handling all of the early ballots. The mail-in ballot counting machines were running in full force so that they could get as many early votes posted at 8 p.m. tonight as possible. Again, Elizabeth Bartholomew.
I think we might be able to have maybe 800,000 tabulated, ready to go in those numbers. And then the remaining 200,000, we will obviously continue to tabulate, but we won't continue that today. We'll probably pick back up tomorrow or Thursday.
She said usually the county can get all of the mail-in ballots and early ballots counted before Election Day, but they got a record number this year, actually. Out of the 1.5 million that they sent out, over 1 million were returned, and they're expecting to see another 150,000 returned in person to polling places today. Those machines can count about 60,000 to 70,000 mail-in ballots every day, so they just couldn't get them done in time.
That's KJZZ's Kerry Young. Thanks, Kerry.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, on this election day here in Arizona, at least one thing seems certain, that the Latino vote will count more than ever.
In 2012, Hispanics in the state accounted for a record 17% of the electorate. This year, that chunk is expected to surpass 20%.
That translates to over one-fifth of Arizona voters, well over a million of them eligible to vote, and 70% of them expected to turn out this election. It's all thanks to efforts made by voter registration groups who have been leading efforts around the state for the past 6 years following the passage of SB 1070. The law was later stripped of its more controversial provisions, including immigration checks deemed to be racial profiling by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the movement continued, and it has continued to grow. Peter Juarez is with the group One Arizona.
All these groups, different organizations that were already working towards fighting that, got together and realized that the only way to fight this was to build something together and register people to vote to actually have a seat and a voice at that table.
And it paid off, as a big increase in Latino voters was credited with playing a large role in the 2011 defeat of former Senate President Russell Pierce, who had authored the controversial immigration bill. And this year, the groups are similarly motivated, claiming to have registered over 150,000 new Latino voters in 2016 alone. Juarez says there are other motivations, such as doubt, citing recent comments made by former Governor Jan Brewer, who was also behind SB 1070.
A lot of people and a lot of the media has said Latino people register to vote, but they don't come out to vote. The governor, ex-governor of Arizona, was recently quoted in the Boston Globe, nah, they don't vote. And we are just here to prove her wrong. We registered historic numbers this year.
And joining us now is Jaime Molera, a former state schools chief and advisor to ex-governor Jane D. Hall and Republican U.S. Senator John Kyle. He's now a partner at the Phoenix-based lobbying firm Molera and Alvarez. So what have you seen from the Hispanic vote so far this election cycle?
Well, I think it's going to be a record number of Latinos voting, not just in the overall numbers, because Arizona's Latino population is continuing to grow. And just from that fact alone, there's going to be more Latino votes. But the percentage of Latino voters, I anticipate an increase. In 2012, we saw almost 60% of a turnout with the Latino population, I think you were going to see that greatly increase this time around. So put all those factors together, there's certainly going to be a much heavier presence with Latinos voting.
Is it because they are being turned out by a specific candidate or an issue? And, you know, you could point to Donald Trump here. He's the elephant in the room. But what is getting them all out there?
I don't care what anybody says. Him, with the rhetoric that has occurred over the last, it seems like the last 10 years, but it's been over the last year, it certainly is bringing out that vote. But conversely, you also have a number of other issues that are playing into it. I think the John McCain race. He's been very aggressively courting Latinos. So I think the more touches Latinos are getting, not just from the traditional, you know, factors like the Democrat Party trying to get the Latinos out to vote, but when you have other initiatives that are out there, when you have a strong Republican nominee like John McCain trying to get Latinos out to vote, I think all of those factors will lead to a much higher turnout.
As someone who has served in office and served others who have been elected to office, as a prominent Latino Republican here in Arizona for a long time, how does this election make you feel?
Well, I'm like any other American. I'm very excited for this election to be over. I think this has been one of the most incredibly vitriolic type of elections that I've ever seen. But it also is heartening in that I think you have a lot of people saying, you know, look, in order to really make sure that my voice is heard, I have to get out and vote. When you put all those factors together, I'm hopeful that this will lead to not just an anomaly of people voting because they're mad. I'm hoping that it'll lead to people voting because they know that in order to affect our government, they have to be engaged.
Jaime Molera is co-founder and partner at Molera Alvarez, former superintendent of public instruction. Thanks so much, Jaime, for your time on this election day.
Oh, happy to do it, as always.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. A lot of changes have been made since Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Many American Indians still have trouble getting to the polls. But that's not the case in Supai Village. For almost five decades, Coconino County election workers have hiked into Supai Village to set up a polling place. KJZZ's Laurel Morales joins me now to talk about this. And Laurel, where is this place and just how remote is it?
So Supai Village is on the southwestern portion of the Grand Canyon. It's a beautiful place. I've been there twice myself, but it's kind of hard to get to. It's an 8.5 mile hike in. You can also take helicopter or ride a mule. It's, downhill going into the canyon, but uphill is a little difficult getting out. And about 450 tribal members live there.
So in terms of allowing those tribal members to vote, how do Coconino County elections officials make that happen?
They have two election workers who have a supai who live in the village, and then they have what they call an election technician who hikes in. They hike in the night before an election day and stay at the poll 12 hours. And then they spend the night and hike back out the following day. A helicopter brings in most of the voting materials and equipment on a pallet. Most people will vote on a touch screen rather than the typical ballots.
For how long have they been doing this?
They've been doing it since 1968. In 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which outlawed racial discrimination in the voting process. And then, so in 67, about 50 Havasupai tribal members came to the county commission and said, we want a polling place. In 1968, they made it happen, and they've had a polling place there ever since.
What does turnout tend to be like?
It's typically pretty low. In the primary, they only have 7 voters cast ballots in the primary. That's a 5.6% turnout. They have 129 registered voters in Supai Village. Today, by 10:30 this morning, they already had exceeded their primary results with 8 voters. But it's typically pretty low. And I spoke with County Coconino County Recorder Patty Hansen, and she explained why voter turnout was so low.
The biggest complaint I get from the voters in Supai is it's really hard for them to get information on who to vote for. Because, you know, candidates don't go down to the village and campaign.
Laurel, in addition to the fact that candidates tend not to go into this area to campaign, do tribal members have any other concerns about their voting process?
Patty Hansen, the county recorder, says on the Navajo Nation, many work outside the reservation. A lot of them come to Flagstaff to work, and so but they're registered on the reservation, so they can still vote in the Navajo tribal election. And there is a Navajo election today, and so the polling places are all set up at the chapter houses, so that they go in, and on one side of the room they vote in the Navajo race, and on the other side of the room they vote in the federal, county, and local race. Because a lot of people work in Flagstaff, they have to plan ahead. They either have to turn in their early ballot, or they have to get to the polling place when it first opens, or when they go home at night. If they had, you know, planned ahead and filled out their early ballot, of course they can turn it in anywhere in the county at any precinct, maybe even after they come into Flagstaff.
That's KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff. Laurel, thank you.
You're welcome, Mark.
Between 2012 and 2014, the Phoenix area saw 21% growth in payroll jobs in ground transportation industries like taxis. But over that same time, the region saw growth of more than 75% in so-called gig employment like Uber and Lyft. The numbers from the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution show similar relative growth for the valley in the traveler accommodation sector. To help sort through what that means, I'm joined by Mark Muro, senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program. And Mark, what were you looking for while crunching all these numbers?
We wanted to get a handle on how fast this is occurring, where it's occurring in this one area, so we can get a sense of, is it growing and outstripping payroll employment? Is payroll employment shrinking because the gigs are increasing? And so on.
And it looks like, based on the data, that at least in the Phoenix metro area, when it comes to one of the categories you looked at, ground transport, which is apps like Uber and Lyft and things like that, the percent increase in gig work far outpaced that of payroll work.
Yeah. The first observation here is, yes, this is growing rapidly. People think it must be. It absolutely is. It's also growing much faster than payroll employment. At the same time, payroll employment in conventional, say, cabs and limousine service is actually growing in Phoenix, too. So both are. To date, they are complements rather than substitutes for each other. That might change, though.
And it looks like in traveler accommodation, the same thing applies. The payroll rate of growth was small, but there, and gig was, you know, considerably higher than that.
Yeah, I think the suspicion of some is that every gain for the platforms is a erosion of payroll employment. So far, and again, I underline the so far, that is not true either in rides or in rooms.
Well, given all of the various reasons why people do these jobs and sort of the factors that lead them to do that, is it possible to describe what kind of impact the rise of gig jobs in the Phoenix area is having on the workforce here?
This is a very partial look. We only looked at two relatively narrow slices of the gig economy. And in there, to date, and these are relatively small industries, we see both growing, both sides of the picture. Remember, though, that the gig economy is far larger and is growing nationally across many industries, including platforms like TaskRabbit, Upwork, Etsy, various other industries. So there are likely thousands more people that are working this way. It is probably not now a huge share of the economy, but all told, some estimates are suggesting it may be you know, 15 to 20%. So it's already significant, and it's clearly growing really fast.
Why do you think it is that the Phoenix area saw the kind of growth that it did, at least in these two particular areas?
Phoenix is clearly near the on the early adopter side of this phenomena, which is moving through the city network over time, but not at the even pace. I think that Phoenix's proximity to the West Coast is important. There are a lot of people going back and forth from the very early adopter coastal West Coast cities like the Bay Area and L.A. You have a significant group of millennials and young professionals who are comfortable with this kind of technology. You have a tech community. They're comfortable with this technology. This definitely seems to be an urban phenomenon. It definitely seems to be one that appeals to millennials.
What kind of growth would you expect to see going forward in a place like Phoenix for both ground transportation and traveler accommodations?
Yeah, I think if you look at our data, there is no way to conclude that it's anywhere near, you know, saturation. The earliest adopters across the country are growing the fastest, which tells me there's a lot of headroom. So I think you're going to see another few years of very fast growth.
Mark Muro is a senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He mentioned the Phoenix area appears to be an early adopter of gig-type jobs, and in fact, his numbers show the Valley's growth in gig jobs is outpacing the national average. To get a sense of what kind of impact this might have on workers here, I'm joined by Rebecca Friend. She's the Executive Director and Secretary-Treasurer of the Arizona AFL-CIO. And Rebecca, let me ask you first off, what do you make of these numbers?
Well, I think they're growing industries because they fit two demands, right? The needs of workers to make some additional money or to have a flexible schedule, and the needs of travelers to have alternatives to get around and also places to stay.
Given what you do for a living, does it concern you that potentially more workers are having these gig-type jobs as opposed to sort of steady employment with benefits?
We do have concerns, and you can see it across the country. I think there's probably, my last look was about six different unions trying to organize, particularly Uber, in various cities, normally the larger cities. And, you know, one of the problems they have is that an Uber driver is a contract employee. So the National Labor Relations Board has ruled that contract employees are not employees, with parentheses around the word. Then there is concerns about how do you judge or how do you regulate corporate accountability when people are outsourcing and or contracting or franchising or offshoring or any of the words we've heard in the last 20 years. What we have seen traditionally is a lot of corporate bad behavior.
What do you think it says about the Valley's workforce if both of these categories, ground transport and traveler accommodations, both categories are growing as far as payroll jobs, but that growth is far outpaced by gig-type job growth in both those categories?
I'm not sure what it says. What I think it says is that people need to work and they need to make money. And because the economy, we had had a recession, another recession, I think people are looking for any way in order to make ends meet for their families. And these types of jobs fulfill some of that. So I think it's more of a worker demand than it is a societal demand to have these services.
Would you expect that in other areas of life that gig-type jobs are experiencing similar growth in the Phoenix area relative to traditional payroll jobs?
I would imagine for the companies that do it, there's a benefit because they don't have the load on payroll, the load being the 401ks, healthcare. So I would imagine for a corporate entity, it might be a very profitable way to do business. However, for the worker, it may not be as profitable or safe or have any longevity to it.
Well, how do you reconcile those two things of what you said earlier about how this clearly being a sign that workers need to work, they need to maybe make some extra money or make some kind of money, with the idea that if you are working one of these gig-type jobs, you probably don't have health insurance or other benefits through your job. You might not have other worker-type protections.
Absolutely. And I think what we need to do, I think there needs to be some definition change or expansion of employee and employer through legislation at the federal, state, and local levels and not have it weakened. I think we need to increase opportunities to access good jobs. I think we also need to make sure that these companies that are doing this gig economy are not getting a competitive edge over another entity for special exemptions from regulation or taxes, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of things we need to do, and I think we need to make benefits portable.
Rebecca Friend is the Executive Director and Secretary Treasurer of the Arizona AFL-CIO. At a time when police shootings are in the news and the conversation around policing is fraught, choosing to go into law enforcement might not seem like the obvious choice for a 14-year-old, especially a 14-year-old student of color. But in one high school in Phoenix, that's exactly what's happening. The show's Naomi Gingold reports.
This is morning assembly at a regular high school in central Phoenix. Okay, regular might not be the right word, but Franklin Police and Fire High School is a public high school in Phoenix. It became a standalone school in 2010. The roughly 300 students here had to apply to get in. Junior year, students join one of two tracks and train to be either firemen or police officers. The law enforcement track is a bit more popular.
My goal is to become an officer, and then from there move on to become like a domestic violence detective and make my way up to SWAT team.
Alejandrina Garcia is a junior, and like many here, decided far before junior year what she wanted to do in life. Second period, the juniors in her track have law enforcement class. Half does their daily training first, running and climbing walls, wearing cumbersome heavy police belts. Students here are expected to meet the physical requirements and similar academic requirements of a police academy.
Stop, police. Do not turn around. Do not face me.
Hannah Archer and Ana Noriega demonstrate how they recently learned to make an arrest. Upstairs in Alejandrina Garcia's class, teacher Andrew Vidari, a former officer in the Arizona Department of Public Safety, shows a new story about a police officer who hesitated to use her gun when making an arrest. She feared public disapproval, and she ended up in the hospital.
The question was about the taser. Now, tasers have to come in contact with two pieces of the body to carry the current. Somebody said, tase him in the face? Negative. The head is always off limits in defensive tactics.
You want to explain on tape what those sounds are?
My fellow classmates, they're cheering me on.
Anaí Cora Podaca is a junior here who wants to be a homicide detective. She was born here, but when she was 7, the recession hit, and her parents sent her to live with relatives in Michoacán, Mexico.
There's a lot of like gang violence. You just hear random shootings.
And the police were pretty corrupt. Cora Podaca is a top student, but many here are like her. Focused, driven, and also like Cora Podaca, 90% of students here are Latino. And her family isn't enthusiastic about her career choice. They've said,
what? You want to be like a police officer? Like, they're bad. They hurt people. And they thought that I was kind of like going to go out and like arrest Mexicans and stuff, and I was just going to become one of them. One of them, like one of the bad cops.
There are students at Franklin who are also undocumented or are residents but not citizens, like junior Alejandrina Garcia. And you can't be a police officer if you're not a citizen.
I do want to become an officer, and I will someday. So I do plan to join the military. I'm still debating about Army or Marines because they help you get your citizenship.
At Franklin, plenty of kids say they want a career in law enforcement, but plenty say they don't.
Some of our students are here because they're interested in being part of law and fire and public service. But sometimes they're here just because it's a small school.
Dr. Tom Narini is the school guidance counselor. Students actually can't go to the police academy in Phoenix until they're nearly 21. And so the emphasis here is actually on college. Franklin has a perfect graduation rate. Last year, seniors were offered more in college scholarships than other good schools in Phoenix, with 7 times the number of students. In class, students do talk about police misconduct, good practices, how the media misses things, but a conversation about implicit bias and institutional racism does not seem to be a part of the formal conversation here. But students, especially students of color, do think and talk about it. Anaí Correa Podaca, the junior who wants to be a homicide detective, says we're all raised with stereotypes and generalizations.
Oh, Mexicans are bad. Black people are bad. White people are snobby. Like, that's not true. Like,
she says generalizations don't work towards any community, including the police.
Like, if we educate ourselves first within our classroom, we could go and bring it out into our community, and little by little, we'll be changing everyone's mindsets. And so we could stop this police brutality, and we can also, like, stop people from thinking the police are bad.
Korea Podaka makes sure to point out to her family now examples of good policing and bad.
And so right now, my family is, like, still kind of iffy about me doing this.
But she says they support her. Naomi Gingold, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a check of international news, could Brexit spell the beginning of the end for the city, as London's buzzing, densely packed financial district is known? The chief of the British Bankers Association has warned foreign banks have their fingers poised over the relocate button out of fear that Brexit will cut them off from Europe. And many of London's European rivals are sensing an opportunity to snatch away some of the city's $200-odd billion worth of business. The BBC's Rob Watson reports.
Avant-garde and traditional, familiar yet flamboyant.
Prime Minister Manuel Valls has already announced that there's going to be some tax incentives.
This is Paris La Défense, and this is where I am.
Ireland has developed a network of dynamic, industry-specific hotspots. Land in one today, and what will you find?
I'm with Gary Kempkin now, Director of Policy and Strategy at the City UK, the representative body of the UK-based financial and related professional services. Goodness, what a mouthful. The French are after city money, the Germans, the Irish, the Luxembourg, presumably other parts of the world. How worried is the city and financial services about Brexit?
The value to the UK economy from straight financial services is about £200 billion. Of that, about a quarter is EU related. And of that quarter, depending on the final deal that's made with the EU, the amount of loss to the British economy ranges from quite minimal, if the current circumstances are replicated quite closely, to something approaching a more significant figure at the other end of the spectrum.
The figures, by the way, at the other end of that spectrum are 75,000 jobs going and over $10 billion in lost tax receipts. If public organisations like City UK are anxious not to sound either too gloomy for fear of being seen to be threatening the government or too optimistic, I'm about to step into one of those fantastically busy city pubs for a less diplomatic take on Brexit.
What do you think Brexit means for the city, sir?
Well, I think it's really bad. 40% of our staff are EU nationals. There was tears in the office on the day it happened. People saying, do you hate us? You see a lot of the European banks leaving the city. I think that will absolutely happen.
The sector I work in, business has slowed down. Absolutely, 100%. And we foresee that dragging into 2017 and beyond. So there's a lot of very worried people at the moment, I would say.
You know what? I just think it's going to bounce back. The city's a unique place. It's going to survive long term, even medium term. I think we'll be fine.
And some think it'll be more than fine. Among them, Richard Lum of the financial services giant Accenture.
You know, the city was not built in a day, and it didn't become a leader because of its passport to the European Union. London offers big advantages for financial institutions. The employment laws, for example, or indeed the tax-friendly environment this year versus France and Germany. So I think the city's got staying power, and it's going to take more than one policy change or Brexit to damage the city.
But he's very much in the minority here amid the gleaming towers and ancient alleyways of the Square Mile, as it's known, where many fear that Brexit could mean an end to membership of the single market and therefore to the free movement of capital and services between London and the continent. All of which could threaten the city's position as the world's biggest financial centre.
And that's the BBC's Rob Watson. A Phoenix-based organization that matches retirees with nonprofits looking for talent has a new CEO. Eric Eilertsen took over as head of Experience Matters earlier this month. And Eric, you're coming most recently from a job leading a Silicon Valley startup. I'm wondering if you think that tech background will come in handy in your new job.
Today we live in a new world and a new time where technology can be a very powerful servant to each of us. Experience Matters is no exception, period. They've done a great job of matching retiring people into the nonprofit communities, but it's been mostly a manual process. My objective is to find ideal technologies that can help facilitate that process and optimize that process to bring the greatest benefit not only to those who are retiring and looking for a nonprofit career, but to the nonprofit organizations in the Phoenix area who also are desperately looking for the right person to fill those roles.
What do you think a program or a system like that might look like?
I think that it's yet to be determined, but I think there are a lot of great opportunities and new technologies out there. For example, everyone has a smartphone today. The smart devices are prolific among all socioeconomic groups. Additionally, we have unlimited access to broadband for the most part, and that gives us the ability to communicate with people in ways that frankly haven't been available to us before now. For example, we can stream videos and things like that, targeted videos that are personalized and valuable.
I'm wondering if you see it as a challenge that basically since the Great Recession, we've heard so many stories about folks who either were planning on retiring or had retired having to go back into the workforce because they needed the income. Has that put a dent in the pool of folks that Experience Matters can connect with nonprofits to help those groups do their jobs?
I think you're absolutely right. The economy does have an impact on the opportunities on both sides, not only those who are retiring, but also for the nonprofits who are looking for valuable folks to fill those roles that they have. That said, I still believe that it's the law of numbers. There are over 1 million boomers in the Phoenix area that are in that age group, and I think there's a lot of opportunities.
I would imagine that one of your objectives and potential challenges is finding those folks, reaching them, and convincing them that this is something that they should be spending their time on.
They're probably two different groups of people, Mark. I think you have folks that have a innate desire and heart to serve, and I think there are those that are not sure how to serve but think they might like to. I'm also aware of some technologies from some companies right here in the Phoenix area that have spent their life and career creating programs to help people understand what their best internal skills and talents are. And I think there's an opportunity to match what people's innate skills are with what an ideal position might look like for them. And at the end of the day, they might be surprised to know they may have spent most of their career pursuing a career that they perhaps were not well suited for. And I think we can help with that. It's a very exciting opportunity.
Eric Eilertsen is the new CEO of Experience Matters. Eric, thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks so much.
Among all the breathless headlines you've heard recently, check out this one.
Forecasting the continued rapid growth of the metropolitan area in the coming decades, a study published Thursday by researchers at Syracuse University has found that the majority of Earth's land masses will be Phoenix suburbs by 2050. Projecting present growth trends forward, we were able to determine that...
That bit of fake research from my alma mater was courtesy of The Onion. The article went on to suggest problems with transportation infrastructure in the expanded valley could add up to 1,400 hours to workers' daily commutes. So yes, this is clearly tongue-in-cheek, but growth and sprawl in the Phoenix area is a real thing. With me to talk about that is Greg Berger, president of R.L. Brown Housing Reports in Phoenix. And Greg, what do you think about The Onion's take on growth in the Valley?
Mark, we do not believe we will be at Mars by 2030 for growth. So that said, the population growth and household growth and job growth really go hand in hand in Metro Phoenix. And we believe that in our five-year forecast period, the sky's the limit for Phoenix housing.
And it seems like there is still sort of a divergent population between those who are looking for urban, dense living, sort of city living, and those who are still looking for what folks often think of as Phoenix in the Valley, which is a little more space, a little more land, sort of maybe a little more on the outskirts.
Well, the high-density buyer has clearly been a strong point in the housing recovery, both here in Metro Phoenix as well as across the country in many geographic areas. We will continue to see the development of higher density products in the downtown areas, the South Scottsdale areas, and other submarkets across the valley here. That same demand, though, has proven historically to be good and will likely be strong over the midterm and long-term forecast here for the next 5 years or so. But that won't deter from the detached traditional housing that we would see in the outlying areas.
And to that point, your most recent newsletter suggested that the most permits in September were in Mesa, Gilbert, and Queen Creek, followed by the Northwest Valley and the Southwest Valley, not sort of the downtown urban cores of the Phoenix area.
Well, that's correct. But again, there's less product available in those central corridor areas for the high density product that you mentioned. Now, there's also included in that is going to be the redevelopment and the revitalization districts of the likes of Arcadia, which has seen strong demand for new housing growth in those older established subdivisions.
What will be different about some of the building on the outskirts in the suburban areas now as compared to before the Great Recession?
Well, prior to the Great Recession, a lot of that growth was driven by the drive to qualify game plan, if you will. And of course, the cost for homes was less expensive in those outlying areas, directly tied to the land cost. So the homes that will be available in those outlying areas will be more expensive than they were in pre-recession, but they will be more affordable than those in the inner loop, let's say in the Metro Phoenix of the 101, 202, 303 corridors.
As far as geography, are developers still looking as far out as they were, as far out from the city center as they were before the recession?
In fact, they are, because again, land costs will drive that growth, and it will be a function of those builders developing lots in those areas that will eventually see the demand for housing growth and job growth. And it has been historically proven and will be in the future that housing growth typically follows the path of the transportation corridors here in the Metro Phoenix area.
Greg Berger is the president of R.L. Brown Housing Reports in Phoenix. You're listening to the show on KJZZ along with The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
In the annals of politics, campaign songs and little jingles get tossed out with the unused lawn signs after an election. But there are songs about voting that have met the test of time. With me now is host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds, John Schaefer. Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Are these songs that you've picked, are they campaign songs? Are they songs for election night? What do you think?
They are songs that are more meta than that. They're about the process. They're about being elected. What kind of person puts themselves in the position of a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton to put yourself out there? The size of the ego, it's not just about being elected. You want more than that. And for me, the classic song that gets to the nut of the matter is the song Elected by Alice Cooper.
I love that. And, you know, for me, since this song came out, it was always Nixon's face in my brain, but now it's Trump's face.
Well, you know, because I want to be elected, respected, selected. You know, it's self-affirmation, but the affirmation of others, of the crowd.
Okay, what else you got?
Cass McCombs is a contemporary singer-songwriter. What I like about his songs in general is they have a kind of wry, vinegary quality to them. And his take on the election process comes out in a song that he calls Don't Vote.
Your uncle had an old saying, if you don't vote, then you can't complain.
Is that the Gen X wine or the millennial wine?
That is neither. It sets itself up as a wine. You know, the old canard, if you don't vote, you can't complain. John, I don't want to give people the impression that this is a kind of a recent development, because you can look back to the mid-20th century. The great jazz trombonist Jack Teagarden, for example.
Love him.
I Swung the Election is the name of this song.
I swung the election, friends. That's no small order. just blow notes, sweep all the votes from Canada to the Mexican border.
That's crazy.
You caught the reference to, the Mexican border? So this idea goes back a long way. And, you know, you can see that a lot of these musicians are kind of having some fun with the idea.
But 60s activism produced an enormous amount of music to go along with it. It really presages the hip-hop era, but it was much more, it seems, preachy and didactic.
Yeah, and that's where this James Brown song comes in. If anybody could make preachy and didactic funky and danceable, it's old JB. He actually did a couple of election songs, but this one, you know, so this is a little more serious than some of the other songs that we've been talking about. Get up, get into it, get involved is exactly what the title implies. It is a call to action.
Everybody over there, get on up, everybody.
Don't stop that.
You can hear him calling back to his hit song Sex Machine.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Get on up.
Of course.
But in this case, it's get on up to do something else, something that's also very important, and that is to get involved in the process. So that's James Brown in a kind of serious mode. And to kind of stay in a serious mode for a moment, the old Delta Blues guitarist Sonnyland Slim, in his piece called Be Careful How You Vote, actually, the warning here is be careful how you vote because the person you elect may turn around and do something completely opposite of what you voted for.
Be careful how you vote, y'all, on every election day.
You know, to bring it all back to contemporary, you know, to 2016, there is a brand new song, came out last week.
Oh, really? Great.
By Jim James, the guy who fronts the band My Morning Jacket. It's called Same Old Lie.
And cheated at, you best believe it's the silent majority. If you don't focus on you,
there is sort of a weird mixed message there. It's the same old lie, but then also that line about the old, if you don't vote, you can't complain.
Right.
Recognizing all of the many problems, at the end of the day, it's still the right thing to do, to go out and be a part of the process.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And that's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. As we heard earlier, people are lining up at the polls this election day and sometimes waiting in that line for a while, like voter Alicia Tucker.
I don't know what the holdup is here. We've been in line like 45 minutes, and it's barely moving.
She was standing in line at Maryvale Church of the Nazarene. So what do you do if you start to get concerned on election day? Well, there are hotlines for that. Some voter advocacy organizations run their own, and states also have hotlines. The show's Lauren Gilger dialed a few numbers to see what kinds of calls they're getting.
Google it or take a look on social media, and you'll find a lot of hotlines you can call on election day.
City clerk elections.
So we called the City of Phoenix's election hotline.
The City of Phoenix, but I can help you.
And the state's hotline, 1-877-THE-VOTE.
Thank you for calling the Election Services Office of Secretary of State Michelle Reagan.
That call was answered after about 20 minutes on hold.
Please continue to hold, and a representative will be with you shortly.
Then they handed it over to Matt Roberts, communications director for the office.
We're sitting at, you know, several dozen deep in the queue right now.
He says, as it happens every year, a lot of voters are calling about their registration, where their polling place is.
Standard election day fare.
Every single call is logged and prioritized, Roberts says. So if they get a report that, for example, an e-poll book in Chandler isn't working, they'll elevate them to the county recorder's office, which is in charge of carrying out elections.
So it's a constant stream that started at probably, I think, the first call we got was about 5:05 this morning.
But if you're met with hold music from one line, there are plenty more numbers to dial.
Good morning, Arizona, but this is Lady Long.
Rinaldo Fowler has been fielding calls for the Arizona Center for Disability Law today.
Yes, but they're not disability related.
He says they're ready to deal with issues of accessibility at the polls, but
90% of the calls are calls regarding voters who did not update their voter registration, went to the polling place and realize their name was not on the list.
Susanna McClay, an immigration attorney in the Valley, has been volunteering since 5:15 in the morning today, answering calls for the Arizona Advocacy Network, a voting rights organization.
We're getting calls regarding machine malfunction sometimes, the length of lines, people who are wanting to check if they're registered, if maybe their name isn't popping up on the polls at their precinct, so we can help them. You know, we can check to make sure that they're registered, to make sure they're in the right place, whether or not they should be submitting a conditional ballot. People want to make sure their vote counts. So we can check all of those things for people.
McClay says she's never volunteered for something like this before, but felt it was important to help out this time around.
Well, it's a terribly important election. I know we've had problems in Maricopa County before, and there's been so much organizing, particularly with the Latino community in Arizona. It's such a crucial election for so many people. I just wanted to be sure that everybody's vote counted and it went smoothly.
And you're going to be there all day?
The polls close at 7, but, you know, if you're in line at 7 o'clock, you get to vote. So we'll be here. I don't know. We'll see.
She says most of the calls they've gotten today have been pretty standard. But after we hung up, they heard from a woman who had just given birth and wanted to find out how she could vote from the hospital. How's that for civic duty? For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.